So now usually on an evening at 8 o'clock we do answering questions. And sometimes if there's a funny questions, sometimes you get funny answers. So it doesn't always have to be serious. Here we go. Wow, a tight one, okay. Okay, the question. Oh, this is a question that somebody asked on the internet. Okay, so they asked this last week, but apparently there was something wrong with the internet. Since most marriages arise out of attachment and not the us of unconditional love, and we get married young with our defilements intact, it seems marriage is a recipe for suffering, especially with male-female differences in libido as we age. Did the Buddha encourage lifelong marriage to one partner, even though most human societies and mammals are not monogamous, and marriage was a barrier to his own enlightenment? So would you give a talk on monogamy at some point? Ha ha ha. Since so many lay relationships fail due to non-compliance with monogamy, it seems that monogamy isn't a problem, but more so our unrealistic expectations that the human animal should live an entire life that way. Wow. So, first of all, yes, marriage can be suffering. As you all know with that famous story of the three rings of marriage. What's the first ring of marriage? That's the engagement ring. The second ring of marriage is the wedding ring. And the third ring of marriage is? Suffering. Those are the three rings of marriage. But of course, it doesn't always have to be that way. And you know, it's not just the fact of monogamy or polygamy. Of course people have those desires, but you know, some of those desires are not just the desires for a nice partner. It's not so much love, but a bit of lust every now and again. And everybody, especially as a monk, we are celibate. And sometimes, I mean, that's one of the most weirdest sexual choices in the world. Because I remember being invited to the Gay and Lesbian Pride Breakfast, because I supported them and the newspapers once, and they invited me to give a speech, and so my speech was, I say, you guys and girls, lesbians, gays, transsexuals, you think you're weird. You're not weird. You know, in fact, there's something which is more deviant than all of you, and that's me. You know, you have same sex, I have no sex. And so for most people, they think that's really weird. So, I asked them, and I said, well, I always promise, one day I'll do this. The next time I have a gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, I'll have a float for celibates. Celibate rites. That's what I call it. No sex, rules okay. But anyway, sometimes when you do get married, you commit to someone, that commitment is an incredibly wonderful thing. For those of people who want to do a spiritual path, I mean, you are letting go of a lot to be able to commit to another partner, to one person. It's not easy, it's a lot of letting go to be done. And if you can commit, again, what happens there, when I keep on saying this in marriages, you look at the wife or the new bride and you say to her, from now on you're a married woman, you mustn't think of yourself. She says, yes. And I do this also in Asian countries as well. It's exactly the same. Then you look at the husband, you know, the groom, and you say, from this moment on, you're a married man. You must not think of yourself either. And even in Malaysia, the groom also hesitates before he commits and says, okay, I won't think of myself. The bride, she always says it straight away. This is anecdotal. This is what I've seen, because I do this a lot. And then I'm still looking at the groom, and I say, from this moment on, you must never think of your wife. And they're looking at the wife, from this moment on, you must never think of him. And that confuses them, because this is where you teach. If you tell people what they already know, of course they don't really pay attention. So now you've got a little riddle there. How can, you know, you live a marriage when you're not thinking of yourself, you're not thinking of your partner? And the answer is, once you're married, you think of us. Not him, not her, not me, it's about us. We're in it together. It's the third option, which most people miss. It's how relationships work. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's all about us. And so when you try and get that across to people, then the relationship starts in a much more sustainable level. If it's just about me, You know, when you don't get what you want anymore, when you've got enough, then you just move on to somebody else. When it's about the other person, you get burnt out. If it really is about us, you're in it together, then it's sustainable. And of course, it does grow over those many, many years. And if there are any problems, whose problem is it? Our problem. And very recently, you know, those of you who paid attention to the people who brought you Dana today, you know, you see the two young ladies and their parents, because I just managed to see them when I came back from the monastery over the road. And I did a blessing for the elder daughter. She's just got a new house just in Mirabuk. I did a blessing for her house. And I asked her, you know, how is it? You know, and how is your parents? And they said, both daughters said, they always argue. And they said that right in front of the parents. The parents were very embarrassed being told off in front of the monk. And I said, it's very easy. There's a solution to this. The Buddhist solution, how you don't have to argue in a marriage. And I asked them, how's it going? 1 week, they haven't argued. So far, so good. So how do you do this? Because, you know, in a marriage, you know, you all want to be right. And you're arguing who's right and who's wrong. And you never get to a solution who's right. So that's a core thing. And just try and make it fair. So he's right some of the time and she's right some of the time. In order to decide this, there's a trick of looking at the calendar. And if it's an even day of the month, the 2nd, the 4th, the 6th, 8th, 10th, 12th, 14th, 16th, 18th, and so on, then he's right. If it's an odd day of the month, the 1st, 3rd, 5th, 7th, 9th, and so on, then she's right. So you don't have to have an argument. Look at the calendar. What day is it today? It's the 6th, 17th today? 17th. So today, all the women are right. But watch it tomorrow. The guys are right. So that way, we're right, you know, evenly, same amount of time. And also, we don't have to argue, because the calendar says, you know, she's right today. So, ways to stop arguments in marriage. And it's fair, you know, that she's right, he's right, an even amount of time. So there's no problem in marriage anymore. That's my solution to arguments in marriage. But of course, you know, after a while, like anything else, like just even coming here, this bonding happens. You know, this is a person you've gone through stuff with. And it's incredible just how that bonding works. And you get very, very close. You can become the best of friends. And it's not just lust which breaks up the marriage. There's so many other things which break up the marriage. And one of the things is just fear of one another. It's one of the other things I say for a marriage. Look, please tell each other, you know, once you start to commit, so darling, you can tell me anything. And as long as you tell me the truth, I won't scold you. I won't shout at you. Because in a marriage, the truth is really important. Sometimes what happens is, you know, you spent too much on the credit card. I said, I better not tell my husband, he'll kill me. Or, you know, the husband, he may be starting an affair with someone. And just, oh God, if my wife finds out, I'll be in big trouble. And so we hide the truth from each other. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing that, you know, if, say the husband starts to feel lustful feelings to someone in his office, and he comes and tells you. Darling, look, you know, I've got these feelings, you know, for this other woman, help. Because that's what we share, you know, we're weak and we want the other person to understand our weaknesses and not to scold us, but to help us. That's what a marriage is all about. But unfortunately, we're so afraid of being scolded, being punished, that we hide the truth. And I think that breaks more marriages than anything else. If you could have a relationship and just tell the other person, darling, you can tell me anything. As long as it's the truth, I'm not going to get angry and upset. So in other words, encouraging truth, and then you can discuss these matters. Why is it, you know, you're starting to feel lustful feelings for somebody else, not yourself? How come, you know, not satisfying each other? Is something you're doing wrong? Because this brings me on to one of the other nice stories, that there was one of the disciples over in Singapore. She was a marriage counselor. She told me this story. She's a brilliant, such a smart lady. Because this woman came up and said, you know, I've had it with my husband. I'm sure he's having an affair. He's coming home late every night. And he doesn't talk to me. I want to divorce him. And the counselor said, well, you know, does he love you? He said, of course not. You know, he loves some other mistress somewhere. Well, said the counselor, if you divorce him now, you'll make him happy. Is that what you want to do? No! I don't want to give him what he wants after the way he's treated me. Okay, said the counselor, this is what you should do. He fell in love with you once before. Get him to fall in love with you again. Start, you know, getting a makeover. You know, go to an expensive salon. Start wearing some sexy clothes. Be a bit more affectionate to him. Because the plan is this. Once he starts to like you again, and once he starts to fall in love with you, and when he has fallen in love with you, then divorce him. Yeah, she said, yeah. So the two of them, that was their big plan. And so, you know, she went to get a nice new hairstyle, started dressing up, wearing makeup and scent and stuff, and he started coming home early. And the counselor would see her every week. How's it going? He said, yes, working. He's coming home early. He's becoming just more affectionate towards me. He said, great. Has he fallen in love with you yet? Well, I'm not quite sure, but give it a few more weeks and then we get divorced. Okay, yeah. And then this carried on. He said, yeah, he's coming home really early now. And then she never turned up for the next appointment or the one afterwards. And that's when the marriage counselor called her up and said, how come you missed two appointments? He said, oh, I don't need you anymore. I said, why? He said, well, he's fallen in love with me. Yeah, great, so let's divorce him. Oh, no, he's so nice now. And the counselor said, mission accomplished. That was the plan after all. because you know, you've done it once before, you can do it again. So it's wonderful to, you know, put some effort into the marriage to make it last. It can be done. Anyway, let's get to something else here. Should people who meditate and say, may all beings be happy and free of suffering, eat meat? No animals like to be killed. Ah, there is. I'm going to get into trouble for this again, because I don't mind getting into trouble. There is a way that a vegetarian can eat a steak, with no problems at all. This is how it's done. So you take a cow, and under anesthetic, you know what's coming, don't you? Under anesthetic, you give the cow a lobotomy. And when the cow comes out of the anesthetic, the cow's a vegetable. And the vegetarians can eat it. Yeah. Thank you. Everyone is so sweet. Very good. What meditation technique would you recommend? What is the most effective way to calm a wandering mind? Now, there's so many different ways of calming a wandering mind, and I'll be telling you many of those little techniques as we go along. But one of the best ones at this time of the retreat is patience. Because what you're doing is starting a whole process of now living a very easy life, having no worries, no concerns. And little by little, you find naturally your mind will start to calm down. You can't make the mind calm. You've got to put all the conditions in place and wait. And your mind starts getting more and more peaceful. So don't get the idea it's something you do. You press a button and straight away your mind becomes calm. No, you're going on this whole process. A very simple lifestyle for the next 8 days. Lots of rest, lots of good food, no silence, nothing much to do, a lot of rest. And some meditation will, little by little, you get more and more peaceful. It gets easier and easier and easier. Just the whole lifestyle. You build up the effort. And the effort is just making peace with things. Being kind, being gentle. Because the only reason why the mind wanders off is because it's not happy being here. That's the only reason. Now why would a person just, you know, get up from their seat and go somewhere else? It's only because you're not happy, you're not content, you're not at ease where you are. And so the whole point of the meditation is learning how to be content right in this moment, just with what you have right now, being at peace with this moment, and you'll find the mind doesn't want to wander off. Sometimes people think, oh no, the mind is just all over the place. It's not all over the place. If you're doing something you really like, say you're watching a movie which you really like, your mind doesn't wander away at all. Now, if you're watching some cricket match, if you're into sport, you're listening to some music, your mind is there in every part of the music. It doesn't wander away at all. Why? Because you're enjoying yourself. The only reason why the mind wanders away when you start meditating, you haven't got enough happiness yet. That will come later on. Not enough contentment. Which means the mind always looks for something else. Now, one of the other reasons why it's not content is because, you know, most human beings are control freaks. And because you're a control freak, now your mind and you have got a very bad relationship. The story I tell, as a simile to make the point, is that this woman got a phone call in the afternoon from an acquaintance, and the acquaintance said, "Are you free this afternoon?" And she said, "Yes." "Oh, great. I'll come out for a cup of coffee." "Now, I know you like your coffee shop, but I like Gloria Jean, so we're going to go there. And I know that you keep on saying that you don't like lattes, but I like lattes, and so that's what you're going to drink. And the chocolate muffins over there, which you keep on raving around, that's really bad for your health. I like the biscuits, so we're going to have biscuits. We're going to sit out the back, not in the front. And we're going to talk about politics, because that's what I'm interested in, not your stupid Buddhism. We're going to talk about politics. And we're going to stay there for an hour and 20 minutes, because that's how much time I've got." Now, if somebody gives you a call and tells you where you're going to go, what you're going to drink, where you're going to sit, what you're going to talk about, are you going to like going out with a person like that? Even for a cup of coffee? Of course not. You're going to come up with an excuse, any excuse to get out of it. You start thinking, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I've got a dentist appointment. It completely left my mind. I've got to go to the dentist. Sorry, maybe next time." Because no one likes to hang out with a control freak. So a couple of minutes later, she gets another call from another friend. "Hey, do you want to come for a cup of coffee?" She says, "Oh, sorry, I'm not free. I've got a dentist appointment." "Well, that's such a shame. That coffee shop which you keep on telling, I'd love to try that. And you say those, you know, cappuccinos are just to kill for, to die for, whatever. I don't usually like cappuccinos, but if you think they're so good, I'm going to try one too. And those chocolate muffins, I know I'm a bit fat, it's bad for my health, but who cares? You know, you like them, I'm going to try them as well. And you've always been talking about your Buddhism. I don't know anything about Buddhism. Let's talk about Buddhism, and we can sit where you want to sit." And if somebody's like that, now they're really caring for what you want to do, where you want to sit, what you want to eat, what you want to talk about, you say, "Oh, I'll cancel the dentist appointment, I'm coming." And no, you maybe only intend to stay there for an hour, but you end up staying all afternoon, 3 or 4 hours. Because you're with somebody who's kind to you, not a control freak. Now the meaning of that simile is sometimes people, when they meditate, they say, "Okay, mind, you're going to watch the breath. Not what you want to do, you're going to watch what I want you to do. You're going to sit here, you're not going to move, you're not going to be in this position or that position. You're going to sit how I'm going to tell you to sit. You're going to meditate for 1 hour, not an hour and 15 minutes, not 45 minutes. I want you to meditate for 1 hour, and we're not going to sort of think about what you want to think. We're going to think about just the breath or enlightenment or something." Okay. It's such control freaks to your minds, telling it what to do. Imagine you sat here with your mind when you start meditating. Say, "Okay, mind, what do you want to do now? What do you want to think about? What do you want to watch? Mind, I will do what you want to do for the next hour." And then you have this beautiful relationship with your mind. So it doesn't wander off anymore. It hangs out with you. Because you don't try and control it anymore. It won't run away from you. Many people, as soon as you sit down, you're like, "Oh God, here she is again, I'm getting out of here." You start thinking about all sorts of fantasies or dreams where you fall asleep, anything to get away from you. That's why kindness is really important in meditation. Be kind to your mind. Don't be so cruel to it. And don't be so critical of fault-finding of your meditation. "I'm a hopeless meditator, I can't do it." Stop thinking like that. Be kind. Give yourself a break. When you have a good relationship with your mind, then you don't wander off anymore. You're always here. Your mind and you are good friends. So don't treat your mind like a slave, as if you can control it and tell it what to do. Treat your mind like a friend, and it will hang out with you. So that's the best meditation, to get out of the wandering mind. When we get our body relaxed and comfortable, what should we focus on? If we feel our body disappear and awareness is strong, any specific object we should focus on? Okay, this, when your body gets relaxed and comfortable, usually the body starts to vanish. And quite naturally, the mind starts to notice things which are moving. First of all, past and future, but that starts to disappear, and the thought starts to disappear. And quite naturally, even if you don't choose to look at this, most people automatically become aware of their breathing. Because this is the last thing which is moving. That early on, when I first came here 31 years ago, there was myself and another monk. And one day, I'd just arrived, somebody invited us to try out a sensory deprivation chamber. Now, just come to Perth. And these plastic boxes in which there was salt water, so you could lay in that, or so a body temperature, so you're perfectly comfortable. You floated. And it was airtight, well, not airtight, but it was soundproof, it was dark, so you couldn't hear anything, you couldn't see anything, you weren't feeling anything at all. And it was supposed to calm down your senses to relax. And I never got to go in it because the other monk got there first. And he went there one day. The following morning, there was a big advertisement in the local paper advertising sensory deprivation chambers as used by Buddhist monks. So he conned us into trying it out so he could advertise that we used it. So I can go into it. But I asked the other monk, what was it like? He said, it was really quiet, except his breathing was so loud. Everything else was stopped, but the breath, you can't stop the breath. So this is naturally what happens when you start to, the body starts to relax. Quite naturally, you can feel your breathing. So that's what most people focus on. You know, the breath going in, the breath going out. I'll say more about that tomorrow, about the breath and how we watch it. It just gives us something to focus on. It's in this present moment. It's a bodily feeling. Stops us thinking. There's not much you can think about the breath. And so you just focus on that and it becomes a very peaceful place you can stay. So that's usually what you focus on, your breathing. And I'll explain more about that tomorrow morning. When you relax the body at the start of meditation, do you scan the whole body or just focus on the tense or sore areas? Usually I just do the tense and sore areas. The nice part, they're already nice, so don't disturb it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So just go to the, you know, the areas which are a bit tense and just relax them, and then the next area which is tense, until the body gets really, really relaxed and you can really let it go. It's the same if you, you know, can't go to sleep at night. A lot of times this is tension from the day, emotional tension stored in the body. You can go to those areas of the body which are a bit tense. I don't know about you, but it's always my legs get tense, you know, after the day. And I can feel tension. And when I relax my legs, you know, the thighs and the calves, then I go to sleep very easily. So maybe just try, find out what part of the body is really tense and relax it. And then you can usually sleep very well as well. Dear Ajahn, previous retreat after a few days during a walking meditation, I saw my desires, expectation of what I wanted out of the meditation. And realized I really wanted peacefulness, etc. It was quite a shock. Well, this is another thought surfacing, or was this the insight? How could I tell the difference between the two? Okay. If it was an emotional shock, that's usually a sign of a good insight. Because, you know, real thinking doesn't have sort of an emotional oomph to it. You know, it's just you have a thought, you've had so many thoughts in your life. But insight is seeing something you haven't seen before. Of course, it's expressed in thinking. But you know, where it comes from is different from the thinking. Now you realize what you really want is peacefulness, and yeah, you should figure out when you want something, that's when you destroy peacefulness. When you let go of wanting, all the peace is already there. So that's why we learn how to be content. Just like we chant, contented and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. So when you're contented, that's why we do the chanting, it's brainwashing. Especially early in the morning when you're half asleep, that's very potent when you're half asleep doing brainwashing. And it means you learn how to be content, easily satisfied. You don't want very much. When you don't want very much, you're really peaceful. And this is what you're going to experience here. There'll be so many moments when you're so peaceful. And you're just sitting out there with a cup of coffee or a cup of tea or juice, just watching the sun go down in the evening or in the early morning. It's beautiful, it's cool. And sit out with a cup of coffee and just watch the sun come up, watch the dawn. So peaceful. Why is it so peaceful? It's because you're sitting there, you haven't got a want in the world. nothing you want, just a nice cup of coffee, a beautiful dawn. Totally satisfied with the simple things. And you realize how easy it is to be content when you don't want anything. So this is where you have the insight into the cause of such peacefulness. You know, you're content. Now you understand what meditation is. And you learn, doesn't matter what's going on in your life, you can always go back to that contentment. Sitting here, closing your eyes, not wanting anything in the whole world. And you get very deeply content then. If you say, and let go of things, do you mean only while I'm meditating or in general? No, only when you're meditating. Because I always say, if you're on the back of a motorbike in heavy traffic, do not let go. Cling on, attach, otherwise you'll fall off. So there is times to let go, and there's the right things to let go of, and the wrong things to let go of. For example, one of the people who comes to our center in Perth, you know, was a Caucasian, he was a businessman, he became a Buddhist. And part of becoming a Buddhist is keeping these five precepts, giving up alcohol. That was hard for him to do. So that when he went to the next party at his company, somebody came around with the alcohol, the wine or the beer or whatever, and said, "Now have a beer." And he said, "No, I can't have that anymore, I'm a Buddhist now." And people know enough about Buddhism that the person holding, give him a drink, "Oh, Buddhism, that's a really good religion, a very peaceful religion. It's all about letting go. Come on, let go and have a drink." It's letting go of the wrong things. So you have to also know what to let go of and what to keep. So, you know, don't let go of your marriage vows. Come on, it's only a ring. Come on, let go, let go. No. Look after your partner. And so there is a time to let go and there's a time to hold on. And that's actually the wisdom. But when you're sitting down meditating, that's just let go, let go, let go all the way. Other times, no, don't just... I know you've all got chores to do while you're here. That's why it's so cheap in this place, because we exploit you. And when you've got a chore, don't say, "Ajahn Brahm said let go, so I'm not going. I'm going to let go instead." And when Bianca asks you, "Where were you?" "I was just letting go." So remember, be wise. Reading your meditation books discouraged during this retreat? Now, you can read the books, but don't do too much reading, because it's the practice which is more important than reading. It's the instruction manuals. So, yeah, instruction manuals are very good. But, you know, if you want to find out, say, you know, what Paris is, or New York, or London, just reading the guidebooks is not going to be much good, is it? So you read the guidebooks and you go there. So yeah, you can read the guidebook, you know, the meditation books, but at least, you know, go and see, check it out, see whether what I described is real or not. If you read about Paris, go there, check it out. Because you find out just the experience is always far more full than the guidebooks. So yeah, you can read it, but don't spend too much time reading. Should a person self-pleasure during a retreat, is this bad for meditation, allowable or good? I mean masturbation. That's what self-pleasure. If that's what it means, no, you don't need to do that, but real self-pleasure is when you're so peaceful, so still, you're really, really happy. This is one of the things which I say in meditation. When you really get into this meditation, you get more pleasure than you've ever had before. That's why, when I, one of the first really good meditations I got, probably the first good meditation, I was only 19, had a girlfriend, I remember having sex with her in Gloucestershire, a few days later was on retreat, blissing out. And because it was so close, it was actually, the bliss in meditation was much better than sex with my girlfriend. It was good sex too, she was a good girl. But, the meditation was better. And that really blew me away, you know, that's just, what's going on? You know, that you get more happiness, more pleasure from meditation than you do with a girlfriend. So, yeah, the answer is yes, you can self-pleasure during the meditation retreat, as long as it's a bliss of deep meditation. That's far better. When we do walking meditation, can we put hands in front of our back, or do they have to be loosely by our side? You can put them wherever you want. So you ask your hands. Hands, where do you want to be? Now, you know, that's not actually a joke. That's serious. Because it's amazing when you ask questions of the body. Now, legs, where do you want to be? Hands, where do you want to be? It's a way of encouraging mindfulness. When you ask a question, you get an answer. So quite often I ask my body when I'm sitting, how are you? Do you want to be moved? Before I ask the question, I'm not aware of the aches and pains in the body. But sometimes when I ask that question, yeah, the body says, yeah, I've been waiting for you to ask this question. Sometimes I ask, do you need a drink? Beforehand, I never thought of that. But now, actually, I'm actually quite thirsty, so I'll take a drink. You see, a lot of times we're not mindful unless we ask the question. So this is what happens. If you ask your head, where do you want to be? You get really good answers. And whatever the body's answers, then do that. It's a way of getting aware of your body. What do we do with a wandering mind? How to overcome it? What do we do when thoughts of the past or fantasies appear? Do we try to focus on other objects, for example the breath, or do we let the thoughts or fantasies be? You let them be, but you sort of don't get involved in them. Now, my story, which I tell on all the retreats, when I was 5 years as a monk, I could leave the monastery and just go wherever I wanted, and I found this perfect monastery. Remember, I was born in England, and this was a monastery in the north of Thailand, in the middle of a tea plantation. I could have all the tea I wanted. It was the middle of a plantation. It was up in the mountains, so it was cool. You know, really high up in the mountains. And there was really good food, and the lay people, all they wanted to do was feed me. They didn't really want to ask any questions on meditation or Buddhism. Just the opportunity to feed a monk every day. So it suited me fine. There's a beautiful cave in there. And I spent such a long time in that cave meditating. I had some great meditation in there. And of course, being a cave, there's lots of bats. And to this day, you know, I tell people this is just conditioning. I associate the smell of bat shit as one of the most beautiful smells. Because I've associated it with just some nice times of meditation. The other smell which I really like is the smell of tar. Because, you know, when I was growing up in a poor part of London, I used to spend so much time playing soccer, you know, in one of the old parks. And during the Second World War, any metal they took away and melted it down to make tanks and bombs and stuff. So they replaced all the metal railings with wood. And every year they'd paint it with tar so it would not decay. And so I spent so much time playing in these parks with the smell of tar. It brings back happy memories of childhood. So those are two smells I really love. Every time I smell tar, it's a nice feeling comes up with it, association. The same with bat shit, because, you know, all this wonderful meditation in this cave. So, you know, I love those smells. So, and anyway, and also just, that was a time, just anecdotes. As the bats flew out of the cave, you know, they usually shout on the way, and there was a papaya tree there. And that papaya, it was the sweetest, juiciest papaya I've ever tasted in my life. Because it got all the fertilizer from the bats. And just one tree there. And I just love that papaya tree. Because it's all made out of bat shit. So it even tasted nice. But when it got transformed into beautiful papaya. But anyway, going back to, what was I talking about? I was getting lost in bat shit and stuff. Sorry? Oh yeah, yes, right. 5 years, that's right. 5 years, and I was meditating. I was alone in this monastery. But then I got into a stage where my mind started wandering off. And it started wandering off into fantasies. You know, into what I call unmonkish thoughts. You know, of old girlfriends. Thinking, well, I wonder if she's still available. No, come on, stop it, I'm a monk. You know, I know I really like being a monk, but these things, they just come up and you can't stop them. And I really tried hard to get these thoughts out of my mind, and it was frustrating. If you try fighting those wandering thoughts and fantasies, it gets worse and worse and worse. And I thought I was going crazy. I just couldn't stop these thoughts. I couldn't watch the breath. And I never had anyone with me to talk to. So that was one of the problems. And so I got so frustrated one day, this is absolutely true, I went to the Buddha statue in the main hall, bowed down, asked for help, and a thought came to my mind to do a deal. And the deal was, From 3 to 4 p.m. every afternoon, I'd allow myself to think sexy thoughts. Anything goes from 3 to 4 p.m. I wouldn't try and stop it at all. But the rest of the day, I'd behave and be a monk. That was the deal. I thought, well, if you want to think those thoughts, 3 to 4 p.m., you can do whatever you want. The rest of the time, watch your breath. But what happened after I made that deal in front of a Buddha statue was as much problem as ever trying to keep these thoughts out. But when it got to 3 p.m., I went up to my hut, leaned against the wall, put my feet up, I said, okay, if you want to think anything, anything at all, sex thoughts, weird thoughts, girlfriend thoughts, you can come. And for the next hour, absolutely true, I watched every breath without missing one. And it was so easy to do. And that was, this really shocked me. And I realized what was happening. Every time I tried to get those thoughts out, I was actually feeding them and making them stronger. And I just let go. Okay, whatever you want to do, mind. If that's what you want to do, it's fine by me. Then the mind calmed down. And you didn't need those fantasies and thoughts anymore. The mind was quite happy just watching the breath when I wasn't trying to control it. I learned a lot about letting go and how we try and control things, we make things worse. We just let it go, let it be. And the thoughts, they just start to lose their momentum. They stop all by themselves. But one other thing happens when I tell this to people, they try and it just keeps on going on because you're not really letting it go. You're right involved in it, actually churning it along, making it happen more and more. You want it to happen. So, you know, you have to be able to let go. And just if they happen, they happen, but not get involved and just, what I call it, giving a separation. And the way to have this separation is using a simile of the TV set. Because I remember when I used to watch TVs that you may be watching for the guys a soccer match. And the soccer match may be, say, the English Premier League somewhere, the other side of the world. And I've actually seen this. People shout at the TV set, "Shoot! Shoot! Offside! Ref! Blow your whistle!" Now, you're sitting in Perth or Sydney. They cannot hear you in Manchester. And it's probably a replay anyway. So why are you shouting at the TV set? And for the guys, you don't need to get embarrassed because the girls do this all the time when there's a movie on. And they shout out, "Behind you! They're creeping up behind you! Kiss her or do something!" You're shouting at the TV set. I remember just going to these movies with the girlfriends. And whenever you went to a horror movie, I always remember the horror movie Tarantula. It's this really sort of stupid movie. No special effects. And this tarantula was supposed to have been in some nuclear accident. It was now 3 times the size of a human being, was eating everybody, and was crawling behind people in the movies. And every time the tarantula was crawling behind somebody, somebody in the theater was "Behind you, tarantula!" You can't warn a person. That's a movie. They can't hear you. But still, you get so caught up, you know, in the action in the movie theater, you shout out. Now, the reason why you get caught up in the movie or in the football match and you shout out, "Shoot, offside," or "Kiss him," or just, you know, "Don't go through the door." The reason why you get caught up is the same reason why those thoughts and fantasies don't stop. You get involved in it. You know, you're right inside it, as if it's actually happening, as if your fantasy is real. So the way to overcome that, if you have a fantasy, you have a sort of some thought of past or future, put some space between you and that thought or fantasy. It's like when you're in your room in your house, you're watching the TV. Just feel the sofa. Look, I'm in my house. You know, I'm not in New York, you know, with the gunman. I'm not sort of in the next episode of Bruce Willis. You know, I'm safe, okay? You know, this is a replay of an old football match. I can find out what's going to happen tomorrow or yesterday. So, you know, nothing I can do. When you realize that you are separate from the action, then you don't get involved. And you can let it go very easily. But when you get caught up in your thoughts, you get caught up in the fantasies, it's like, you know, being on the football terraces. You know, you're actually sitting in Perth, but you're in Liverpool and Anfield. or you know, you're in some movie set somewhere. You're not, you're at home. Remember where you are. And then you can actually put distance between you and that fantasy or that wandering thought. And it can stop very easily. You don't try and force it to stop, because you won't be able to. You just give it more energy. You don't get involved. You actually separate yourself. You know, the watcher from what you're observing. And then it's very easy to let go of. And then you get so much more peaceful. It's worth it, because, you know, the peace you get in meditation, you know, just the movie just goes on and on and on. And just what next? I think it was you was telling me that, or someone was telling me, that that's one of the other ways of stopping fantasies and dreams. You said, then what? Then what? So, you know, you find your perfect partner. Then what? You know, your football team wins the FA Cup or the Champions League. Then what? And asking then what, it just takes away all the fun. Because apparently that there's a movie, a then what movie, somebody was saying, called Into the Woods. I said, that's right, wasn't it Into the Woods? Where it actually tells you what happens after Cinderella and Prince Charming, after they get married, then what? And the Seven Dwarfs, what happens to them, you know, after, you know, Snow White actually marries the prince. You know, it's actually getting all these fantasies, these fairy tales, and then seeing the next episode. And they're all killing each other. I think the Seven Dwarfs turn out to be gay because they've been spending too much time with each other. Whatever, I don't know what happens. Prince Charming gets a mistress. Whatever it is. Now, the whole idea of then what? You know, afterwards, you know, it takes away all the fun of the fantasies. So that's another way. Anyway, I seem to be bombarded with thoughts about problems at work, mostly recent and even from the past. They may be pertinent to my life, but a waste of time at a retreat. What do you do with such reoccurring thoughts? Thank you. Remembering you're not being paid. So refuse to do work when you're not being paid. So, you know, all the thoughts of work, you're not working now. So you're not going to get paid for what you do on this retreat. So refuse to do any work for whoever's doing it. But it's true. Bombarded with thoughts about work. It's just the fact that, you know, that's been your life. You've been conditioned to keep thinking about work. And little by little, just remind yourself, you know, you're on holiday. You're away from work. Remind yourself. Remind yourself where you are. And keep that mindfulness of being in Jhana Grove. And then you find the thoughts about work get less and less and less. Number two, remember, you deserve some rest. And it'll be good for your performance at work if you can take some time off. Because when you relax, take time out, it means when you do go back to work, you've got fresh ideas. And also, you know, you've got energy, you know, to face the problems of work. But if you really waste this time thinking about those problems of work, you're wasting time. And you go back to work, you know, almost as tired as when you left. So please remember, you deserve this break. And when you deserve this break, you realize that. And realize it's going to be good for your work. Because you're relaxing. Then afterwards, you realize it's worthwhile not thinking about the work. Years ago, I was in Thailand just on a domestic flight, just reading the newspaper, and they said the best hotel in Bangkok was the Oriental. It won the award for the best hotel in the world that year. And I actually, one of the managers there I knew, she used to invite me every year. Fortunately, she's moved. But when I used to go there, what's really famous is the onion soup at the Oriental Hotel in Bangkok. So it's amazing as a monk, you know, you get to do all these amazing things. And so they gave me the onion soup. It's famous for it throughout the world. So if you ever want to indulge, the onion soup at the Oriental Hotel in Bangkok. Put that on your bucket list before you die. But anyhow, I had the best hotel in the world prize. And they're interviewing the manager. Said, how come, why do you think that your hotel was the best hotel in the world? And no, he said, because I sent every one of my staff, every one of them, cleaners, concierges, you know, people who do the bookings, housekeeping, everybody, managers, I sent them to a Buddhist monastery for 1 week meditation every year at the expense of the hotel. It's not taken off their leave. It's part of the training. Because I found, he says, when people go to this retreat for 1 week a year, paid for by the hotel, they come back relaxed. They come back, they're far more sensitive to our clients. And the clients, our customers, notice that. And so our customer service level just goes up because of that. The stress levels go down. And you don't get so many people taking sick leave. And they say this because they send every employee to a meditation retreat once a year at the hotel's expense. So next time you want to come over here, get your CEO of your company to pay the bills and send you here, not on holiday time, on their time. Because it actually does work. You go back refreshed, even new ideas, and are much more sensitive to one another. Dear Ajahn, may you kindly elaborate on the nature of rebirth producing craving, its cause, fuel, how we can live a happy life with non-rebirth producing craving. Okay, this is a more technical, like how rebirth happens is because you want to. There's many types of wanting. There's a gross type of wanting. It may be that, you know, you've died young and there's somebody you really love very much, maybe parents, children, you know, a lover. You just want to come back again, want to have it all over again. You haven't finished yet. And that's where you do get love at first sight experiences. You know, there's a one retreat some years ago, I forget who they were, there's an incredible couple. So I think she was Russian, I think he was maybe Dutch or something. And she just looked at him. Now, they never met before. And she went right up to him and she said, "Your name is Dave and I'm going to marry you." And straight away, hadn't seen him before. Of course, his name was Dave. And they came here. And, you know, you're supposed to be sort of keeping all these precepts. But those two, they couldn't separate them. I put them in different cottages, but that didn't work. They're incredibly sort of close together. And it's obviously from past life. They recognize one another. And she even knew his name before she'd even met him. So it's incredible sometimes, the karma from the past, how strong it is. So that type of craving, that gets you to come and meet together again. But there's also other cravings. Sometimes one of the most hard ones to overcome, and this is what you actually see in meditation, is the craving to be, to exist. Because a lot of times in meditation, things start to vanish from you. Things which you really think you are, like your body. It starts to vanish. And if you really attach to your body, and I really mean that you think that, you know, you are this body, that you are English, you are Malaysian, you know, you are Singaporean, you are whatever. When this body starts to disappear, it starts to challenge you. And you get a bit afraid sometimes, the body's vanishing. Because it's like you vanishing. And many other things about you start to disappear. And that's actually where you realize what letting go is. Letting go of your idea of who you are. And that's one of the biggest things which causes you rebirth. But that's such a big question, it's really, can't really sort of talk about it now. That's a whole talk. While going to sleep, I normally let go of the mind. The mind will wander around and the consciousness gradually fades away, going to the sleep state. But if I concentrate and be mindful, it's hard to get into sleep. So what's the difference of lying down meditation and mindful sleeping? As a person normally doesn't drink coffee, is it right to have some coffee during meditation to stay awake? Sometimes it's very good to have vitamins. So I was telling someone last night or this afternoon, I say it's very good to, when you're here, to have either vitamin T or vitamin C. Yeah. And actually, like, these vitamins, you get an instant effect. Vitamin T is a cup of tea. Vitamin C is a cup of coffee. Vitamin caffeine. So you can use those things if you want to. And in Buddhism, especially tea became, you know, it was the Buddhists who really started the tea thing with the Bodhidharma. And they even say in China that tea started, you know, when this monk, he was getting sleepy. And to stop him getting sleepy, you know, these myths of these super monks, he cut off his eyelids with his razor so he couldn't go to sleep. You know, whether you believe that or not, but apparently the myth was, and where the eyelids fell, that's where the first tea bush came from. So you didn't need to cut off your eyelids anymore, just drink the result of that, which is tea, and you'd get sort of some energy. And that became such an important part of Buddhism. That's why you get the tea ceremony and everything else from these places. So tea is very, very, very Buddhist. So coffee, well, same sort of stuff. So you can do that. But if you want to go to sleep, if you let go of the mind, that is meditation, letting it go and just letting it get to relax and become peaceful. But if you concentrate, concentrating is controlling. I haven't mentioned this yet, but this is not a concentration camp. Concentration is not the right word. Stillness, relaxation. Because they have a word in meditation called samadhi. Very often people translate the word samadhi as concentration. That's a very bad translation. And that's caused such mischief to people trying to meditate. They think they have to concentrate. If you try and concentrate, you just get more tense and tired. It's nothing to do with concentration. It's all about stillness. And if you translate the word samadhi as stillness, not concentration, stillness, it gets very clear how to become still. You have to relax and let go, and then stillness is there. And this is the way of meditation, the still mind, not the concentrated mind. Concentration is too much force. And exactly, if you use force and try to concentrate before you go to sleep, you're too much force, you're waking yourself up. You're not becoming still enough to go to sleep. You're just agitating the mind more and more. So you just learn how to let go. And if you want to have a nice way of going to sleep, many people have told me this, you know, when I travel around the world. And Paris, very, very popular. I mean, I'm honestly saying that this actually works. They listen to one of my talks before they go to sleep. And I don't know whether that's a compliment or... But I know how it works. It's not because it's boring that I go to sleep. It's because it teaches people how to let go and relax. And they let go, they relax, and you know, before the talk's finished, they're in a deep sleep. So a lot of people have said they can't go to sleep without listening to one of my talks. In walking meditation, do you keep your focus on your bodily sensations or do you gradually move to watching your breath? Usually the bodily sensations. In walking meditation, we don't worry about our breathing. We just let the breath do the breathing. We just focus on our bodily sensations. But if you move towards the breath, you know, you can focus so much on the breath, you don't know what your body's doing, which means you keep bumping into walls or tripping over stuff. So no, keep your attention on the sensations in the body. Could meditation with learning about the Dharma lead to enlightenment like Lord Buddha and you have attained? Actually, the Lord Buddha actually also, this is a technical point, you do need meditation and some knowledge of the teachings. So how could the Buddha get knowledge of the teachings? It's quite obvious when you look at the story and use your brain. Under the Bodhi tree, so the Buddha didn't have any teachers. No, he had some teachers, but they weren't enlightened. He, under the Bodhi tree, he got into the jhanas. And after the jhanas, the first thing he remembered after emerging from the jhanas was his previous life. And the previous life, you know, was these Jataka tales, especially, you know, the Vaisantara Jatakas, they are just so concocted, that's not valid, that's not authoritative. The previous life of the Buddha in the sutras is in the Gatikara Sutta, where he was a monk under the previous Buddha, Kassapa. So the Siddhartha Gautama, previous life, he was a monk, Jyotipala, under Kassapa the Buddha. And so if he remembered his previous life, and that's not that long ago in the whole scheme of things, he would have remembered that life, the time he was a disciple of another Buddha, and he would have remembered some of the teachings that Buddha would have given him. And that was the teachings which he used under the Bodhi tree, together with his deep meditation, those two, to become enlightened, become a Buddha. So really, it wasn't just by his own doing. He had a teacher, the previous Buddha, which he recalled. Because you can't do it just by yourself. You do need teachings, as well as meditation. What is the difference between Zen meditation, washing a white wall, and the meditation taught here? Do both lead to enlightenment? The main difference is, you don't get hit with a stick here. That's really dangerous. People said it didn't hurt. But if ever you asked anybody who'd been to a Zen retreat who did get hit by the stick, It hurts. I went to a Zen retreat once. It was only a weekend. And the master went behind everybody with a stick. I never got hit. You know why? Because the person sitting next to me got hit. And that was enough to scare me awake. It really sounded like it would hurt. And as soon as the guy sitting next to me got hit, my back was straight. And I wasn't going to be sleepy at all for the rest of the retreat. But it was just from fear, nothing else. But also that when I was in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, you know, in these monasteries, you get all the gossip. Monks gossip like everybody else and find out what's going on in other countries. He'd just come from mainland China. And he said one of the latest bits of news from mainland China was a Zen retreat where the master was using the stick. And this one middle-aged lady, you know, from mainland China, she started going to sleep, so she got hit on the back with the Zen stick. And immediately she got out her cell phone and called the police. And it's true, the police had no choice. He had to arrest the monk, and that was the end of the retreat. Because you can't do that these days. You can't go around hitting people, not even on a Zen retreat. So the poor monk got arrested. So that's a warning for everybody. You know, something's bad. Don't use the Zen stick. You're liable to go to jail for that. So it's obviously, it was went around all the monasteries. Be careful. So watching the white wall eventually disappears, but it's much easier to actually to close the eyes. And does it lead to enlightenment? There's a great saying by the Buddha when somebody asked him, do all these traditions lead to enlightenment? What about non-Buddhist traditions? Can you get enlightened in a non-Buddhist tradition? And the Buddha gave this wonderful answer. As long as you're practicing the Eightfold Path, it doesn't matter what tradition it is or what you call it, as long as there's the Eightfold Path happening there, you're going to get enlightened. So it's not what you call your practice or what you call your religion or what you call your sect. It's what you do which matters. So and if you're practicing, you know, things like right view, right intention is making peace, being kind, being gentle, you know, right speech, action, livelihood, you know, keeping precepts, being virtuous, you know, being mindful, the effort to stop and being still, you're going to get enlightened. Doesn't matter what you call it. So it doesn't matter what religion you call it, it's what you do is important. Where do you keep attention during meditation, breathing or the body? The best answer to that is what I said yesterday, whatever's in front of you, whatever you're aware of right now, then that is where you put your attention and you care for it. So you don't choose. You don't control the meditation. Because what usually happens, first of all, you're aware of the body. When the body goes, you've got the breath. It comes to you. So you're aware of that. You don't try and get rid of it to go and watch something else. And after a little while, the breath vanishes. And you get these beautiful lights I'll tell you about later on called the nimittas. You don't say, I should go back to the breath. I've lost the breath. No, whatever's in front of your mind is what you watch. And soon you get this incredible ecstasy and bliss coming up. That's just what you watch. You don't go back to nimittas or don't worry about the breath. Whatever's in front of you. In front of your mind, that's what you watch. That answers the question. That's actually very, very profound. It stops a lot of problems in meditation. And you get very deep, very quickly. How do you know you're meditating correctly? Because you're happy. When you meditate correctly, sort of the mindfulness increases, you see more things, and what you see becomes more beautiful. Just generally get more happiness. In Pali, more piti sukha arises. So you can tell the people who get the really good meditations. When you come to the interviews, it's not what you say. I look at the shape of your mouth. If it's turned down, no. Horizontal, okay, but not good enough. If the corners are turned up, yeah, you've had some good meditations. You can't fake it, it's just so easy to see. That's how you know you're having good meditation. You're enjoying it. Having happiness. In the lying down meditation posture, do we lie on the right side or left side? What is the normal practice? The position is so comfortable that one usually ends up sleeping. Is there anything you can recommend to prevent this? Yeah, it doesn't matter what side you lay down or whatever side is comfortable for you. But if you want to stop sleeping when you're doing the lying down meditation, everybody usually goes to sleep in one position. I usually do it on my right side. And that's where I usually go to sleep. I never go to sleep on my back. You know, I don't know why I don't go to sleep on my bum, I just don't do that. So if I were to do laying down meditation, I don't want to go to sleep. I lie down on my back. That's the position reserved for meditation. Every other one is going to sleep. So my psychologically, my mind recognizes, oh, he's on his back, he doesn't want me to sleep. So keep awake. So find out how you go to sleep at night. Where do you start? And don't lay down like that. And then psychologically, your mind will realize, oh, now she's not in the sleeping position, so it must be that I can keep awake. But the other thing is just, you know, don't use a pillow. Because if you use a pillow, bed means sleep. So just, you know, the psychology is just, everything is telling you it's supposed to go to sleep, so you do go to sleep. But you will notice something very, very strange during this retreat. You come up here into this hall to meditate, and you will fall asleep. You'll go back to bed in the evening to go to sleep, and you'll stay awake. What's going on? It is because when you come to this hall, you're trying to meditate. Therefore, you go to sleep. When you go to bed, you're trying to go to sleep. That's why you stay awake. Stop all this trying, and then in bed, you can go to sleep. And here, you can stay awake. Is walking meditation a substitute for sitting meditation, or should it be combined with sitting meditation? It seems to be hard to make the body disappear because you need it for walking. So how can you get enlightened if you always feel and need the body? Okay, you do it as a gap between the walking meditation, but you can get very peaceful, you get great insights when you're doing walking meditation. So it's not a second-class meditation. It's a great meditation. You get lots of insights when you're doing walking meditation. But don't just do walking meditation. If you keep walking, you wear out your feet and your legs and you get really tired. So you do some walking meditation, then you do sitting meditation, then you do walking meditation, then you do sitting meditation. You know, you go from one to the other. So you can keep up the peacefulness, the present moment awareness for long periods of time. And usually, and after you know, you feel that you've done enough walking meditation, then you sit and get very deep afterwards because the body is relaxed. You've got no aches and pains and you've been already doing a lot of mindfulness, you know, of your bodily feelings. So it's very easy after doing walking meditation to get some nice deep meditation during sitting meditation. So it's a very good thing to do. Last night I couldn't sleep. I was restless and anxious and unfamiliar with the noises and even the cold air. It felt like I hardly slept the whole night. Is this normal for the first night? Yeah, of course it is. Because you have something, I've used this for stages of meditation. The three levels of every stage of meditation. First of all, it's recognition, then familiarity, then ease. And it's like the room. Now, when you first come here, you don't know where you're supposed to go. You don't know the place and you don't know the people sharing the cottage with you. So there's a lot of tension there, fear, and it's just natural. So the first night in a new bed, I get this when I go and stay in a hotel, I travel around a lot. The first night, you know, even though you know it's safe, you're not used to the place, so you never sleep deeply the first night. The second night is much better. The third night is always really deep. Because, you know, the body and the mind gets used to the place. So this is to be expected. The first night in your room, you won't sleep that well. Tonight it will be much deeper, and the third night it will be hard to get up in the morning. It's just like your room, it's your bed, you get to know it and it gets to know you. And it's the same with any of these deep states of meditation. When you first get a deep state of meditation, you're very peaceful. It doesn't last that long. And actually you disturb it on purpose because you're not used to it. But after a while you recognize it, you become familiar with it, and then you can relax, you're at ease with it. So that's actually also happens in the meditation as well. So tonight would be much better. How does one combat dullness in meditation? Somebody actually asked me in the mental hospital on Thursday, said, how do you deal with boredom? And I said, now what you're doing here is like a doctor. He said, great, as a doctor, you should do, as a psychologist, you should do an investigation, do a PhD into boredom. For example, when you're bored, how does it feel? Does it always stay the same? What does boredom feel? Describe boredom to me. And is it always just the same level of boredom? Is there really deep boredom, really intense boredom, or very wide boredom, or it's brought among you some things and not other things? Does it register in the body? How long does it last for? And I say, you know, boredom is a very interesting subject. And of course, once it starts to get interesting, it's not boring anymore. So if you're dull, investigate dullness. How does it feel? Is it always the same? When you get dull and super dull and mega dull, and just, you know, sometimes you're dull and you get gaps between the dullness, investigate it. And then dullness becomes incredibly alive and exciting. What a wonderful thing to investigate, dullness. In other words, if you try and get rid of it, it gets worse. But if you try and care for it and investigate it, it soon vanishes. And anyway, the dullness is usually only the first few days of a retreat, because when you start to get energy coming up, nothing is dull at all, and everything is incredibly beautiful. How can I use walking meditation while walking to my office? 20 minutes walk. I have to take care of traffic, other people. Sometimes I meet people I know, and they expect me to greet them. All this could disturb the walking meditation. Okay, I know a person who does that in New York. They go from meeting to meeting. They do walking meditation between the office blocks. So in order to not have to be disturbed by greeting people, just put some earplugs, you know, into your ears. You don't have to have an iPhone. You don't have to have it turned on. When you've got the earplugs in, people think, you know, you can't, you're listening to something. So, you know, they can talk to you and you don't have to respond. It's a great way. I use that sometimes in the aircraft. You know, I put on headphones. Even though I'm not watching the movie, they think I am, so they don't talk to me, so I can meditate in peace and quiet. It's not really lying, or maybe a bit of deceit, but it stops them talking to me because they think I can't hear. I can hear, but I pretend I can't. So, I tell you all my tricks. Yeah, no, now you're going to come and sit next to me in the aircraft and say, I know you're not doing and ask me all your problems. You know, that happened to me once. I was flying back from Kuala Lumpur, all the way to Perth. And this was just, you know, and I was working so hard on a retreat, and the people, it was in a retreat in Malacca, and they picked me up from Malacca and took me to the airport, and all the way they were talking about their problems and meditation, family problems and stuff. And when we got to the airport, we'd get you a cup of coffee, and of course, just an excuse to talk to me some more. So, you know, there's a counselling all the way to the airport. And so I'm crikey. Now I can get on the aircraft. And I got on the aircraft, had a window seat. So at least I know that one side no one's going to talk to me. And on the other side a guy came and sat next to me. He didn't know me from Adam, so I was fine. And then as the passengers were going in, this woman stopped and looked at me and said, "You're Ajahn Brahm, aren't you?" I said, yes I am. Why? She said, I really want to talk to you about something. And I said, "I'm terribly sorry, but this gentleman's got the seat over here." You know what this girl did? She talked to him, "Sir, would you mind exchanging seats?" And I was thinking, "No, please don't do it." And he said, "Yeah, no problem." And she had me all the way from Kuala Lumpur, it's about 6 hours, talking about her marital problems for 6 hours without rest. Jeez, I wish I'd have got those earphones on quicker. And there's no escape. You know, in an aircraft, and she's got the aisle seat, and I'm in the window seat. She's got me cornered. That was really bad karma. So anyway, so the suffering of being a monk. Anyway, so this is what you can do. And so you don't have to greet them, and yeah, of course you take care of traffic. That's easy to take care of traffic when you're mindful. You just stop and just wait. So it's a very good thing to do. You can walk quite slowly. And you can actually preserve all of your energies so you don't get stressed out. How do I deal with my family resistance to my being here? They were upset and hostile and said I was escaping, dealing with my life and problems. Ha ha ha. When you go back, they'll look at you and think, wow, you are so peaceful. Because there was this, there's lots of stories. One story, there was this man, he always, you know, one of our regulars at our city centre, always wanted to go on a weekend meditation retreat. And he'd tell his wife, "Darling, there's a weekend meditation retreat. Can I go?" And she'd say, "What do you mean, being selfish and going? The weekends we've got to do the shopping, the cleaning, take the kids to the sport. Of course you can't go." "Okay, darling." And he was a very smart man. Because he would ask every time, he just wore her down. Every time a retreat, said, can I go? He said, no, of course you can't. Mother-in-law's coming. No, you can't. You've got to do the jobs which I gave you. No, you can't. And then one day he asked and said, there's a weekend retreat, can I go? And she was so upset with him. She said, okay, you just go and be selfish. Leave me with all the work. So he went. He took that as a yes. But then what happened? When he came back, he told us, when he came back after a weekend retreat, he was really such an improved husband. His wife saw it straight away, and she was so impressed. He told us the next time there was a retreat, he didn't even need to ask. She gave him the money, off you go. Because she liked her husband after he'd come back on a retreat, from a retreat. It actually did work. So when you go back, you know, with your family, and they see the changes in you, I almost guarantee this, they will say, wow, we didn't realize, you know, how good that was. And they'll say, you know, here's some money, go again. They'll see the results. And the other thing was, usually when we have a evening meditation at Armidale, this always seems to happen at Armidale, sometimes these middle-aged women would come up to me and say, I never felt like coming today, I was busy at work, I came home, I just wanted to relax in front of the TV, but my kid told me to go. Mummy, are you going to meditation tonight? I said, no, I'm too tired. Mummy, you must go to meditation. But I don't feel like it. Mummy, go to meditation tonight. Why, darling? Because you're a much nicer mummy when you come back from meditation. From the mouth of kids. So you do actually get much better after you meditate. One last question. There's a few left, but I'll do those tomorrow. We have come from far and distant places to hear you. Can we please have guided meditation? That would be wonderful. Thank you. People often ask for guided meditation, but sometimes some people like it, some people don't like it. So what I encourage you to do, if you have got your smartphones off something, there are some guided meditations available on the internet. Danny can actually post them, how you can download them. So you can download them on your device, and you can put those, the earbuds in, you know, in here if you wish, as long as it's a guided meditation. And you're not listening to AC/DC when the meditation hall or whatever else you want to listen to. But you know, you're listening to actually just some guided meditation. Then actually you can do your own guided meditation. Well, it's obviously someone else who's doing the guiding. You can actually listen to it in here. Because sometimes that's the very, very best. So, I mean, most of you have got these devices, even though you're not using them. Some of you are. I know what you're up to. But... But, you know, you can actually download these things, guided meditations, and you can play them to yourself. Which means that, you know, we don't have to start all the same time, we don't have to finish all the same time, and you can do it any time of the day. So, that's what I'd recommend, rather than doing actually a guided meditation for everybody, all in one go. It doesn't seem to fit on a retreat, when you do guided meditations, because some people come early to meditate, some late, some after them. After the talk, then I go into the interviews tomorrow, so it's hard actually to fit it in. So please ask Danny or Mike, maybe you can post some up somewhere, how you can download some guided meditations, and that means that you can do it yourself.